Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it is Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And so many wonderful, crazy changes going on. I got to be honest, I'm having a hard time keeping up with recording because I am so busy at Ona's that, it's like juggling. It's definitely tough. I wish I had more hours in a day because I love recording and podcasting and having new guests on and all the things. But such is life. Some exciting news about Ona's right now is that there's been some, we've had incredible growth, first of all, over the last, since I arrived, but we had some incredible growth this last year, and it was tough because there was a lot of supply chain issues, and there was a lot of things that were changing, but it was great because everyone was loving Ona's and the new products, but then we were having some backorder issues and supply chain issues and things got a little nutty. Well, one of the things that my partner and I thought we would do was reformulate the Luna Oil 10%. For those of you that love the Luna Oil, it's the one product that we have that can be used both orally and topically. But now we have Luna Oil 5% that has a little bit of spearmint in it. And this was my lovely idea because I thought, why don't we have a product that can help with some of the bloating and distension that comes along with hormone imbalance? And a lot of women, and this is fascinating, and I'm doing a Substack article that will be out tomorrow, so you can look basically on gut health and hormones and weight gain, insulin resistance, etc. And it's a good one. It's one of the free ones. So please go to my Substack. That will be in the show notes. But basically, why some women take progesterone and all of a sudden they have a gut response to it. And they feel like it's the progesterone that's causing bloating and causing slow motility, constipation, etc. And in the Substack, I have some clips posted from Kiran Krishnan, the microbiologist who addresses the specific issue. And he's basically stating that when we start to take progesterone and we're deficient and it stimulates estrogen, a lot of people in my group know this as estrogen kickback. When that stimulates the estrogen gets, it ends in the gut, right? When it gets dumped, it goes through the liver, it gets broken down and it goes into the gut. And then we pass it out. A lot of times it'll go into the urine as well. But so it gets pooped out basically. But when estrogen gets into the gut, it actually creates inflammation, slow motility, constipation, especially if you are not detoxing it well. So when you start to take progesterone, you can blame the progesterone for this, but what's really happening is you're stimulating the estrogen detox response. So that's really good to know. And so a lot of women have this experience, not just when they supplement progesterone, but when they have premenstrual syndrome, PMDD or PMS, you get those period cramps, those period poops, the gas, the bloating, the distension, all that stuff. That is a byproduct of the estrogen, all the estrogen that we're getting rid of, that we're detoxing out. So when you have estrogen dominance, this can be heightened. So one of my ideas was because I personally don't like taking oral progesterone, like oral oils and like even the Progest-D and the Luna oil. I have a strong gag reflex and I'm not a fan of those tastes. So it's hard for me, but I know that they're absorbed better in a lot of women. So I'm like, bummer, I really want to do it, but I won't be consistent if it's gross. So I asked the group what flavor we should use. I decided that I thought it was best to use a really tiny amount of spearmint just to cut through that flavor that you guys, you know the flavor I'm talking about. And I picked spearmint because it is really, really good for, it's a carminative. It's an herbal carminative, which its action is to literally reduce distension and gas. So you can put it in your belly button. It tastes really nice, so it's refreshing. And it's not too tingly if you wanted to apply it vaginally or rectally. So it's a great product. It's only 5%. That means that it's going to be highly absorbable for almost every woman, where the higher strengths like 10% and 20% get more difficult to absorb. But it's a great product. So there's that, and that's just called Luna Oil 5%. And it's a green label. It's awesome. I'm very proud of it. And then the Luna Oil 10%. I know a lot of you like it, but we were having some issues in a lot of ways. One of the issues was that it was, if it's in high heat or high light, a lot of light, even in the amber bottle, it can fall out of dissolution. And that's not good. It didn't happen often, but it did happen. And so it also is hard to absorb. So, and then it required an enormous amount of vitamin E to make it, which is why it was more expensive. So what we did was we came up with a 10% that has an additive that is phosphatidylcholine or sunflower lecithin. And we have a different type of vitamin E from sunflower, which is great because this particular vendor and sunflower vitamin E is easier to come by and we don't need as much. So there was a bunch of reasons why this product, for cost, for supply issues, for absorption, and then the sunflower lecithin is actually a component of oral progesterone Prometrium, like what you would get from your doctor. That is bioidentical, and they used to use it because it had some studies on it showing its efficacy with absorption at the gut, and that's really good news. Well, they stopped putting it in Prometrium because it was expensive, and they would rather use peanut oil, which of course is garbage. So we decided to put it in our new reformulated Luna Oil 10%. However, we changed the name of it to Luna Snow. It looks like it's absorbing even better, so that's a really exciting thing. It's a milky color, and it's a clear bottle, but it'll probably go into a black bottle soon. Anyway, those are details you probably don't care about, but I just wanted to tell you that we are going to discontinue the Luna Oil 10%. The Luna Snow is just as potent. In fact, it's probably even better because it's more absorbable than the other one, and you're not going to have issues with it. You just need to shake the bottle before use. That's the big change. Okay, so those are my updates and my messages, announcements for you about Luna Oil, about Ona's, and the changes that we're making. And yeah, so if you have any feedback, I'm open. I'm ready for it. Let me know in the group, or you can message me privately. All that info is in the show notes. So this next guest, this is very exciting. His wife, Jennifer, was in our group 8 years ago. Years ago, probably at the beginning of the group. And we, you know, became friends via the group. And one day, my husband and I go up to Nevada City and we fall in love with it, which is a small city up in the Sierra Nevadas in California. And we fell in love with it. We ended up buying a house up there. And when we went up there to close on the property, it's a 6-hour drive, by the way. When we went up there to close on the property, we're stopping to put gas. When we get there, we're putting gas. And I'm just like, no makeup, just like road trip face, road trip hair, road trip crunchiness, because it's been 6 hours. And I walk into this like 7-Eleven or whatever, and I'm going to use the restroom. And I hear, "Healthy Gut Girl." And I turn around and it's Jennifer. And I was so embarrassed because I look like, you know, 40 miles of bad road. And she was just lovely and gorgeous. And she was with, I think it was her fiance at the time. And I met him and they were moving. She was leaving, moving away. They were moving to Texas. So I was coming, she was going. Anyway, needless to say, we stayed in touch. And they went this interesting route with their health journey. And he started the Copper Revolution, which a lot of you in my group are in that group too. And it's a lot like Morley Robbins in many ways, the root cause protocol, but different in many ways also. So, Jason Hormel is here to talk to us about the copper revolution.
Well, tell me why you made a splash. What happened? How did you come to this copper revolution? And yeah, like where, how did you get there?
Excellent question to start with. How did we make such a splash? The big thing is, first of all, copper. My book is titled The Copper Revolution, Healing with Minerals. And that's because copper is misunderstood by everybody. Both in mainstream medical, they all think copper is toxic at like 2 milligrams. And then in the alternative world, they all think copper is toxic too. So there's like, there's almost nobody in the world that's really promoting copper, except for maybe the people who make copper supplements. And when I first started getting into high copper, I cleaned out like the entire city of Lubbock, all the health food stores, all their copper. It was gone. We had to go to Amazon to get it because they just wouldn't restock it because there was nobody buying it. And I couldn't really find anybody out there promoting that people should take above the suggested upper limit of 10 milligrams. And when I got into it, it was because one of my readers was trying to fix a bleeding problem. And I found that interesting. And I said, well, here's everything that I'm doing. And actually I had nosebleeds, and my nosebleeds, I hadn't had one in like a year and a half, which is really crazy for me. It's been a lifelong problem. And when I explained everything that I was doing, she then came back a few weeks later and said, did you know that copper helps stop bleeding? I said, I did not know that. And then I decided to test not taking copper to see if the nosebleeds would come back. You have to test. And so I stopped taking copper. Huge mistake. I had brain fog that came in, and I almost forgot about my experiment. But I knew enough to remember that when the nosebleeds came back that, yeah, I have to take the copper again. And when I took the copper again, I felt so much better. And then I was like, well, wait a second. Can't I take more than 10? What's the deal? Why is there the limit of 10? If I remember reading, it was a bit fuzzy because they said taking, if I remember correctly, they said taking 10 milligrams of copper is the level that does not cause any liver damage. That's a really weird thing, because where's the level that does cause some liver damage? And the answer is they haven't found it. And they said we should do more testing to determine the level of copper that might cause some liver damage. And they've never done such further testing since 1993, when they created their upper limit.
Interesting.
So that's super interesting. I mean, I'm like, that's sort of right, because they kind of inferred that they thought that it should be right around the 10 milligram level, but only by inference and by, you know, bad studies and studies that hadn't been conducted. They never conducted a study showing that 15 milligrams or 20 or 30 or anything. It's wide open. They said that we should do more studies, but they've never done them since 1993. This is pre-internet era.
Wow.
So this is 30 years ago, and they haven't done a single follow-up study to determine the level of copper toxicity. It's weird. And yet, you know, all the hair, most all the hair tissue mineral analysts out there, they tend to believe in the concept of copper toxicity, that you can get copper toxic at 2 milligrams. It's absurd. So I will say, now we have been taking for the last 5.5 years now around 30 milligrams of copper a day, plus 70 milligrams of copper topically head to toe almost daily, sometimes every other day. So we're getting a ton of copper and no toxicity at all. Some people on our forum have gone up to 100 to 200 milligrams. Some people accidentally swallow an entire bottle of 1,000 milligrams. At that level, they typically...
That's some accident.
Well, sometimes people talk up copper to somebody else and they see the bottle and then they drink the entire little 2 ounce bottle. So we tell people make a 2 ounce bottle. It has about 1,100 milligrams in it. And when you talk it up so well and you realize all the benefits, these people are like, okay, I'll drink it, because, you know, people will drink an entire bottle of magnesium for constipation, so they don't think anything of it. It's significantly more powerful when it's made at, you know, a milligram per drop. Anyways, the difficulty at that level is people will vomit continuously for a few hours. But of the three people who've done that, the following day, they said they've never felt better in their entire lives. Because copper is a wonderful detoxifier. It's needed by the body to make collagen and energy, ATP production. And when we get our ATP production up, everything comes together. wakes up the nerves. That's probably why people vomit, because it wakes up the vagus nerve so strongly, and then that can create the vomit response. So copper was used as an emetic to induce vomiting for, I don't know, 50, 100 years or something at the 100 milligram level. And it always works for kids at that level. Sometimes we use it at 500 milligrams to induce vomiting, for adults or even higher than that. So it's fairly safe.
I was going to say, that sounds like a that's a pretty high limit to go by. I mean, yeah, it might make you vomit, but is it toxic? Is it poisonous? And that doesn't sound like it is.
Drawing a lot of toxins out. So one of the things I learned was that copper and vitamin A move inversely in the liver. There's a rat study on that. And in the study, unfortunately, they did a typo. You have to infer that it's inverted, but you can infer that it's inverted because of the title, but there's a typo. These things happen. But anyways, as copper goes up, vitamin A goes down. As vitamin A goes up, copper goes down.
Well, that's interesting. So how is your revolution, how is it similar to the root cause protocol? Do you know about Morley Robbins' root cause protocol?
We do. He helped me get some of my first interviews, like the one we're doing right now.
Oh, awesome.
When I was writing my book, he published his book about a month before mine was due.
Oh.
And then I took some time to, you know, converse with him quite a bit and think more about my book before I decided to publish, because he got there first. I recently finally found the time to completely investigate his protocol and then compare it with my own protocol. I thought there were going to be, I don't know, 7 to 13 differences. But when you really do your homework and you look at every line, I found 22 differences between his protocol and ours. And I just recently wrote that article. It's on my website at revealingthrive.com. The main differences are that from my perspective is he likes to take a more conservative approach. He calls me like the Rambo of copper. He's more of, he calls himself like the James Bond, stealthy or something. But he does not recommend taking more than about 4 milligrams of copper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking 30. It's like this for a boron and iodine. He recommends, you know, 3 milligrams of boron, maybe low dose iodine as well. But we are on high dose iodine and high dose boron. So we've taken boron up to 100 milligrams. I've scaled back to 50. I think that's a little better. On iodine, I'm around 300 milligrams. So our protocol is an outgrowth of the high iodine protocol from the iodine doctors, along with a bunch of other modifications. So in other words, I believe in supplements, and Morley believes in more like getting food amounts of the supplements. And if we don't have to take supplements, then that's probably better.
Yeah.
I just don't think we can get it from the food, but go ahead.
Anymore. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I was going to say, I think it's any more these days, it's very hard to do. And, you know, I think the vitamin A thing, I really have a lot of questions about that, because first of all, it's really difficult for people to convert vitamin A from like beta carotene at the liver and gut. And so we're all kind of relying on liver and cream and eggs and all these other food forms of vitamin A. But I'm like, gosh, it's not really helping me. And I know that it's important, but you literally say that vitamin A is toxic. Now, speak more on that, please.
Okay. So before I just jump into that one, because I know it's very controversial, we've made about 50 such decisions, because we're taking 20 things and we have a list of 30 things we're specifically avoiding, and vitamin A is one of them.
Okay.
So this is, you know, 50 very hard
decisions. That's like the vitamin D of the root cause protocol, right? Like they've got their like, don't take that.
Well, so I found that was one of the things I was going to talk about, is that you're acknowledging that vitamin D can cause osteoporosis on your page. I think I said that there, or saw that you're against vitamin D supplementation. And so are we. I didn't get that from Morley, but I was surprised that he had come to that decision too, because that alone is very controversial too.
Yeah, he has. But I've since changed my stance on that a little bit.
I went back a little bit. So my stance is not exactly that vitamin D is toxic. I'll get back to vitamin A in a second.
Okay.
But we're just not taking vitamin D supplements because we're making vitamin D in our protocol. There's a woman who, in our group, and she said she could never get her vitamin D levels above, I don't know, 25 or whatever, while taking vitamin D. And then on our protocol, she got her vitamin D levels up to 50, like no problem, while stopping taking vitamin D as a supplement. So that's very interesting. Yeah. So I have about four or five different reasons why taking copper increases vitamin D in the body. First, it makes our skin tan. And when our skin is tanning, that's when we're making vitamin D. Second, we're making more ATP in the body. And with more ATP, the body does everything because we have more energy. Third, copper helps us to make hormones and helps us to convert a lot of hormones. You've heard of bad cholesterol. Cholesterol, if you just look it up at Wikipedia, you can see that the molecule for cholesterol is very similar to estrogen and testosterone. It just needs a little trimming to turn cholesterol into testosterone. So it's not necessarily a bad thing as long as the body can convert it. And copper helps us do that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we don't need cholesterol lining the arteries to heal our arteries if we're not bleeding from copper. So vitamin D is a hormone. So our bodies are able to make it from copper. A couple other things is vitamin D is used up. It's used up and used to kill germs. But copper itself kills germs. So if we're not having a germ problem in the body, then we're not vitamin D wasting. So we have higher vitamin D levels naturally. So we're getting, and a lot of these nutritional studies are only associational studies. So they're only associating that high vitamin D levels are correlating with health, or low vitamin D levels are correlating with illnesses. But you can't always fix that just by taking vitamin D because, the secosteroid hormone group, the vitamin D guys, they say, look, you can't just take a hormone because the problem is there are maybe 15 to 20 different vitamin D hormones in the body. And so if the body's not making and converting hormones, that's a bigger, more important thing to fix than just trying to supplement with one. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, what do we hear about hormones? Hormones are often called signaling molecules. Well, what's the signal? If in order to make the hormone, we need copper, maybe the signal is, hey, there's enough copper to do stuff. But if you're copper deficient, taking an artificial hormone might very well be the wrong signal. Mm-hmm. And that could apply not just to vitamin D, but also to melatonin or to estrogen or testosterone as well. Mm-hmm. Like, what do we need testosterone for? For healing and growth. But if copper is needed for healing and growth and the copper's not there, what could happen? Taking testosterone is shown to cause copper deficiency and make it worse. What do the bodybuilders die from? Heart disease. Mm-hmm. And heart disease is correlated with copper deficiency. I know that's a big, long answer, but...
No, it's good. Cool.
Now I want to get back to the vitamin A question. Because again, we're not against vitamin D. I'm more against vitamin A. I do believe that it tends to be more toxic than we realize. And the first evidence that I will bring for that is the upper limit is said to be 10,000 IUs. Well, what's an IU? Why aren't they counting it in milligrams? The conversion of 10,000 IUs is 3,000 micrograms. And again, why micrograms? What about, let's just use milligrams. It's 3 milligrams is the upper limit for vitamin A. That indicates that, hey, if you take more than 3 milligrams, you're going to cause all sorts of vitamin A problems. That's openly acknowledged. But they don't know exactly around that level because blood tests for vitamin A don't work, just like blood tests for copper don't work, just like blood tests for potassium doesn't work, just like blood tests for iron doesn't work, because very often the nutrients are stored elsewhere in the body. So they don't really even know if 3 milligrams is the toxic level for vitamin A or not. It could be lower. Mm. And now when we say 3 milligrams, I'm converting that on to that level on purpose because you know that's a very small amount. Mm-hmm. And vitamin D is even worse because vitamin D is measured slightly differently. So the toxic level of vitamin D might very well be a half a milligram or less. I'd have to go back and check my notes on that. But
well, I know that something like 25,000 IUs is like a toxic level, or that's, I've heard a lot of different things, but right. Do you know what that converts to, or you don't know?
I think the 25,000, well, see, IUs for vitamin D are counted differently than IUs for vitamin A.
Okay.
That's part of the problem. So I know what the vitamin A conversion is, but I don't know what the vitamin D conversion is offhand. I just know that it's a lot smaller in terms of overall amounts. And hey, if those really tiny milligram amounts are toxic, that stuff is really toxic. Mm-hmm. And I know people say, oh, well, your argument, Jason, that vitamin D uses rat poison doesn't count because, you know, they give so much more to rats than to humans. But the mechanism of action is the same. It can calcify the soft tissues. And if it calcifies the soft tissues over a long time, that's what happens with slow poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
When the mechanism of action is the same, that indicates that you're getting it at a toxic level.
Right.
You know, vitamin K can fix that, but that does not mean that vitamin K is a co-nutrient, and it doesn't mean that vitamin D itself isn't having toxic reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So we just don't need that. Now, with vitamin A, again, I'm trying to stick with the subject. With vitamin A, again, if 3 milligrams is quasi-toxic, that indicates the stuff is very toxic. In fact, a lot of people are getting more than 3 milligrams just of fluoride per day. And we all know fluoride is awful. So if over 3 milligrams of vitamin A can cause problems, that indicates to me that it could very well be more toxic than fluoride.
Well, why do you make that correlation? What does a vitamin A and fluoride have to do with each other?
In terms of their amounts that create toxicity.
Couldn't I say that about anything? I could say, you know, 3 milligrams of sugar versus 3 milligrams of rat poison. Like those are just so vastly different from one another. Like vitamin A is an essential nutrient in the body, right? Fluoride isn't.
Well, who told us that vitamin A is an essential nutrient in the body? A pharmaceutical company that invented the synthesis of it back in, say, 1925.
Is that so?
And just because they were able to take a natural plant substance and synthesize it and call it something brand new, because this was the very first vitamin that was ever discovered, it was the very first thing that was ever called a vitamin.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? We don't, you know, I mean, how many B vitamins have been called vitamins that are no longer B vitamins because further science has come out? I think there's about 17 of them. And so.
But don't we know that retinoic acid is really beneficial and important? I mean, in the body
I don't really know. I've been looking for that. I'm looking for, you know, hard proof and not from some study pulled up from 1925 that doesn't remotely prove what they say it proves.
Mm.
The very first vitamin A study was a study to determine whether or not lard contained vitamin A. That was the question. It was highly debated back then. And what they did was they gave lard, milk casein, and corn, cooked corn or cornmeal or something, or maybe it wasn't corn. Maybe it was maltodextrin. It was like a derivative of corn, right?
Mm-hmm.
They gave just only those three things to rats, and they degenerated. And then they did another study, and they added a little bit of butter. So 5% of their diets contained butter. And they said, well, we know vitamin A is in butter, so therefore that first diet must not have had any vitamin A in it. Okay?
Mm.
That was their way to prove that lard does not contain any vitamin A. That's not a proof of that, for one. Okay. We don't know whether lard has vitamin A in it or not, but what do you know about vitamin A? We know that it's a fat soluble vitamin. And what's lard? Lard is rendered pig fat. So why wouldn't there be vitamin A or retinol in lard? Some people suggest, well, there's probably a lot of vitamin A in lard. And other people say, well, what about casein? Casein is in milk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's milk? Milk is a natural high vitamin A food. So there could very well have been vitamin A in the milk as well, and as well as in the corn.
Hmm.
So in other words, there might have been feeding these diets, not a vitamin A deficient diet, like they tried to assume. They may well have been feeding them a very high vitamin A diet, but yet there's something in butter that mitigates the harms of vitamin A that was able to stop the degeneration that was happening.
Hmm.
So the guy who's done a lot of research on this right now is Grant Genera, and he has written 3 books now on vitamin A and made them free eBooks. And I read them all, and I don't agree with all of his arguments, but some of them are almost unassailable. And I will bring forth his strongest arguments against vitamin A. And that is in World War II. So he's determined that the lowest vitamin A diet that you can get would be rice, beans, and beef. Not refried beans and only some beans. Some beans have some vitamin A in them. But that's his recipe for a low vitamin A diet. And he's been on a very strict low vitamin A diet for himself for 8 years. And he doesn't have any vitamin A deficiency problems whatsoever. And all of the vitamin A deficiency problems that we know of today go back to pretty much those original studies. And those original studies were obviously bogus. So on his low vitamin A diet, he doesn't have any low vitamin A problems. And that's somewhat compelling. Go ahead.
I had to go down that the vitamin A rabbit hole because of Morley. and because I wasn't getting enough, and because my eyesight has always been a thing. And so I found several studies about vitamin A. But what I'm really curious about now is what you're saying about copper and its relationship to vitamin A. And that's really interesting to me, because I think the vitamin A concept, you know, like this study here is vitamin A is required for male fertility. And then it goes on to talk about that. And then also about eyesight. But it's all dietary animal vitamin A. So it isn't like, you know, vitamin A from beta carotene. It's like retinoic acid, ultimately what it gets broken down into. But I just think it's so hard to acquire for so many people. So it's weird to like, I mean, I have a hard time getting enough of it because I can't do a ton of dairy.
What kind of symptoms do you get when you're low in vitamin A?
Well, my symptoms, I feel like could be a lot of things. Like when I was reading your stuff, I was like, hey, and Morley's like, my gray hair. And I was going gray since this bit here I've had since I was 17. And it just got whiter and whiter and whiter. And now, you know, I'm just like salt and pepper everywhere. I mean, I am 54, but
53.
Still, yeah.
So a little bit of white here and there, and that's happening. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not like losing sleep over it, because I think it looks quite cute. But but my thing is like my eyesight, like everything I do, you know, it's just like my eyesight. And it just seems to just get, and it's what's really weird is it gets worse and then it gets better. And a lot of eye doctors are like, that's not real. That's actually probably something.
My eyesight fluctuates too. I'm trying to get a handle on that on myself. When I was in my mid-20s, I began drinking a 32-ounce glass of carrot juice on a regular basis. And I walked my own vision out of like a diopter and a half on one eye and three quarters of a diopter on one. And each quarter diopter is like a huge click on the, you know, run them through. So I got significant improvement. And I've been wondering how in the world did I do that on carrot juice if it's high vitamin A?
Mm-hmm. Well, and maybe you're converting the beta carotene to retinol.
Well,
maybe your gut is stable enough to do that.
Maybe. I don't know yet if vitamin A is really important for vision yet still, though. Grant,
so that's what Morley was
argument, but he's only one guy.
Yeah.
And maybe there's more. I mean, I know that it's found in the eyeball, but it probably isn't used exactly the way they think it does, because otherwise, if we needed vitamin A for our vision, we would run out and our vision would turn totally cloudy and we wouldn't be able to see anything at times. And we'd have to keep our A levels constant. We'd have to just completely, it'd be fading in and out all the time, and that never happens.
Yeah.
Another argument is that if we need it for our vision is clear when our lenses are working right and they're able to be adjusted. And in a healthy person, there's not supposed to be any vitamin A in the lens at all. And vitamin A gets into the lens only when there's cataracts. So high vitamin A causes the blindness.
Yeah.
It was those rats on the high vitamin A diet that they claimed was low vitamin A diet. So they think low vitamin A causes these blindness problems, and it doesn't. But one of the other compelling arguments against vitamin A as a nutrient is that in World War II, on both sides, prisoners of war were fed like almost nothing but rice and maybe an egg. Mm-hmm. As rations. And at the end of the war, people were totally starving. And yet vitamin A deficiency is supposed to show up within 6 weeks. And yet none of the prisoners of war had any problems with vision at the end of the war. That should have been a thing. I mean, if within 6 weeks of vitamin A deficiency, how is it that Grant is able to go 8 years on a low vitamin A diet and he still has good vision? Mm-hmm. The hypotheses when tested in the real world don't work. Mm-hmm. And the hypotheses were put forth by a pharmaceutical company that I just can't find any further evidence that they're right. And the original evidence does flat out doesn't say what they have, what the conclusions that they've derived from that those studies are. It just doesn't match up.
Well, I liked what some of the stuff you were saying about the deficiencies, and it reminded me of what Morley was talking about with me and saying, you know, about the gray hair, and that he said his big thing was bioavailable copper. So let's talk about that for a second. So which correlates with the vitamin A as well. But So, you know, a lot of people will listen to this and a lot of people listen to Morley, and then they go run out and they go buy copper and they start taking copper. And Morley's like, yeah, that's not a great idea. That's not a great thing to do. You want it to be bioavailable. And that is so you want to increase, you know, your vitamin A, your vitamin B, your vitamin C, your vitamin in your magnesium. And you want to help chelate out the toxic iron overload in your body so that you can offset that toxic burden of iron and start to make the copper you are acquiring into usable bioavailable copper. So what is the difference here with your protocol in terms of like bioavailable copper just versus me going to the grocery store and buying a copper chelate or copper whatever, citrate or whatever?
So in my opinion, all copper is bioavailable. I have to go through my evidence for that.
Okay.
Your typical copper glycinate or copper chelate pills that are found in the stores, those are 85% bio, not bioavailable, 85% absorbable. And copper sulfate that we take is 80% absorbable. So there's no absorption problems for copper. Second is that everyone says, it has to be in the ceruloplasmin. However, what we know of copper is only what we know of in copper deficient people, because high copper people have never been studied. So when they say that the average person has 95% of their copper in ceruloplasmin, the average person is copper deficient, wildly copper deficient, because the average person only gets about 1 milligram or less, or 80% of people are getting 0.6 milligrams of copper or less. The government, when they were coming up with their RDAs, they found out that if you give people 0.6 milligrams or less, 8 out of 10 people will develop copper deficiency symptoms that are so bad and so dangerous. They had to halt their experiment, and they said, we'll never let that experiment ever be done because it's so dangerous. Yet 80% of Americans are right there in that same situation, that they haven't added any copper to the food supply. It's almost a crime, based on their own language, that we should never replicate this experiment because it's too dangerous. Yet 80% of Americans are now in that same boat. So 80% of Americans are in copper deficient mode. 15% of Americans are getting 3 milligrams of copper in a Centrum or multi-pill supplement that's made by the pharmaceutical companies. And it's loaded with so much iron and vitamin A that all of that 3 milligrams is effectively and totally blocked. So there's nobody out there reaching 1% of the population, at least, that's even supplementing copper, because all the copper supplements are 3 milligrams or less. So there's no high copper control group except for us. In my study of what copper does, it does about 200 things. And all of those things I feel in my body are totally fixed. So when people are in the group and they're like, hey, my white blood cell count is high, I'm like, yeah, that's what copper does. Congratulations, you're healthier. Or my red blood cell count is high. Congratulations, copper's doing what it's supposed to do. You're healthier. You're like a well-trained athlete who's been training at high altitude to get your red blood cell counts up, but you've done it without blood doping. You've actually taken copper. And this is actual evidence that the vast majority of the population is copper deficient, because we're getting red blood cell counts above normal, which basically means everybody has a low-grade level of anemia all the time. Because we're the only group that has high red blood cell counts above normal. In other words, everybody should be at our level, because that's healthy. That's what endurance athletes do. They train at high altitudes to get higher red blood cell counts so that they're healthier, so that they can win races. And we're getting that just by taking copper. So basically everybody else is suffering under anemia levels, or really bad anemia levels too, which is becoming an increasing problem.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get back to what the question was.
It was about bioavailable copper. And you said all copper is available.
So the copper we're taking is available to us, is my point. Mm-hmm. And we're not having any problems, and we don't need to take vitamin A to make it more available. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a study I shared with Morley. I asked him his opinion on it. I said, here's a study that shows that ceruloplasmin goes up in rats fed a vitamin A deficient diet. So what do you have to say about that? Because that contradicts your theory. He said, yeah, but that's a rat study, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, he shares rat studies all the time.
No, that's not exactly the right conclusion. The conclusion should be, something more along the lines of, well, why? Or, well, that's interesting or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, it's very curious, well, for sure, the whole thing about...
Is, how is it that if we take vitamin A, ceruloplasmin can go up? Because that also happens. How is it that ceruloplasmin can go up with vitamin A and go up with no vitamin A? That's the real question.
And meaning I have, that, like, for Morley, like, how...
Yeah, because vitamin A does cause ceruloplasmin to go up. So in my research, I found that ceruloplasmin is what they call an acute phase reactive inflammatory biomarker protein. So when there's inflammation, the body will raise ceruloplasmin levels. And also maybe the body also makes more when there's no vitamin A because the body's not being poisoned and doesn't need as much. But it's hard to come up with whys when there's mysteries, but mysteries should be looked into and not dismissed.
Right.
But the point is we don't need vitamin A to make ceruloplasmin. Rats are able to do it just fine. And it's probably the same way with us. I don't feel I'm ceruloplasmin deficient, not mm-hmm. taking vitamin A. So all the evidence is that we don't need vitamin A to make copper bioavailable.
Okay.
There is one evidence where that happened in somebody with Wilson's disease, which is a very special rare case and doesn't apply to everybody. And try to apply Wilson's disease to everybody is also a big mistake because I don't know.
That's not everybody has
almost
Wilson's
as funny
disease.
As ignoring a rat study or overapplying a rat study.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up anemia. So where does copper fit into the iron issue, the ferritin storage, iron toxicity, toxic levels of bound iron in the tissues? Where does copper fit into your copper revolution with when it comes to anemia and anemia of inflammation?
So I think Morley is very, very right on that particular issue, that we need copper to make iron bioavailable. And so when iron is not bioavailable, people can be loaded with iron, but yet it's detected as iron deficiency or anemia only because the iron is not being properly mobilized and turned into the red blood cells with copper. In fact, copper helps fix anemia in like four different ways. It makes longer lasting red blood cells, better shaped red blood cells so that they're not as small or not as large. They're more effective in carrying oxygen, longer lasting, better shaped. There's like four. And more numerous in the body. So what's really weird is that iron will block and lower copper, but copper does not block and lower iron. You would think it would work the other way, but it doesn't. Instead, copper makes iron more bioavailable, and it fixes problems of both high iron and low iron, because the problems of high iron and low iron are almost the same, kind of a similar cause, because iron can be trapped inside the cells and just not be mobilized to be used, but you could still be high iron. In fact, that's probably the vast majority of cases, is that everybody is high iron, because we live in an iron-dominated society where they're fortifying our foods with iron. In fact, all the major food groups have iron. Meat is naturally loaded with iron. All carbs are fortified with iron. And then greens are high iron. So show me a diet that you could eat that wouldn't be high iron. You can't do it, because everybody's going to have to eat either meat or vegetables or carbs. What else are you going to eat if not those three things? Those are the staple foods, right?
I'm a fativore.
Fativore, right?
Yeah,
you're only eating fat or something.
You never know.
Donuts,
diets...
I suppose you could become iron deficient, but no, because donuts have
no,
carbs,
the flowers.
So you're gonna get, there's your iron right there.
Exactly.
So there's nobody who's not getting iron. It's just if you're copper deficient, when copper deficiency is rampant, like I proved, because we're increasing our red blood cell counts with copper. It's a copper deficiency problem, and copper deficiency fixes problems of both high iron and low iron, because both of those problems are the same. It's the iron just not being bioavailable, or a person has toxically overloaded themselves with iron trying to fix the iron problem, and more iron can't fix the iron problem because more iron is just going to deplete the copper, and then you're back to not being able to use your iron. Why is the medical establishment going to iron infusions? Because, the theory is they're not absorbing the iron. It's not that they're not absorbing the iron. It's that they're copper deficient. They've missed that part of it.
That makes so much sense to me. That resonates with me very, very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. So
That was a good question that we got to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's important because it's an ever more important problem. And it also goes to show the failure of the medical establishment that they, when people suffer copper deficiency, what they do is they give them a half a milligram copper injections. And they only diagnose copper deficiency when a person's ends up with spinal cord lesions and their spinal cord degeneration or their myelin sheaths are destroyed and they're in a wheelchair and they practically can't move and they practically can't think and they're practically done. Then they'll say, ah, it's copper deficiency. And then what's the treatment? Half a milligram of copper being injected. They almost will never tell the person, well, you need to take 30 milligrams of copper because they're afraid that too much copper will cause nerve problems. And it's the only cure
wow.
for the nerve problems.
That's
so they have
very
it backwards because their medical model is copper toxicity causes Wilson's disease. And Wilson's disease is presented by nerve degeneration and liver disease. But it's copper's not the problem there. That's also just another form of copper deficiency.
Mm-hmm. You know, my mentor used to say that he used to recommend that people eat dried apricots, like Turkish apricots, dried, because they actually help to chelate the toxic iron from the liver out. And he said, because they're so high in copper. This was back when I didn't know anything about copper.
Oh,
and he said they're very, very, apricots are very high in copper.
I don't believe that that's true anymore. A lot of our produce has lost about 95% of the copper levels that it used to have going mm-hmm. back, let's say, only 75 years. So,
well, I think that's probably why he says Turkish apricots, like purchased from, like, you know, you can buy Turkish apricots from Turkey.
That might make sense.
Yeah.
One of the only high, oh, this brings me to one of the things I wanted to bring to your attention is that you mentioned shellfish is high in copper. And in my research, yes, shellfish is high in copper. It's like, it goes like liver can have up to like 64 milligrams per pound. Oysters can have like 30 milligrams per pound. And then like all other foods are not per pound per serving or whatever. But the point is, it's like 64. Well, I think it is per pound because, you know, you could theoretically eat a pound of liver. Not anybody does that, but it goes like 64,
yum.
32 for shellfish. And then like almost all other foods, it's like 1 milligram or less. So without shellfish and liver, there would almost be no food sources except for chocolate. Chocolate is high in copper.
Mm.
But the problem with oysters as a source of copper is that they have 18 times as much zinc as copper. And at that ratio, you're probably going to deplete all the copper that they give you. So shellfish is not a good source of copper. Even though it has copper within it, we likely can't absorb it in our bodies. And then the trouble with liver is that while liver is said, and I put this in my book, so my book has already become slightly outdated. Sources on the internet will say it's 64 milligrams of copper per pound in beef liver, but some beef liver has zero copper. And why is this? Partly, I think, because of the antagonism that I shared with you in that it could be vitamin A, could be depleting the copper. But if the animals are copper deficient, then the liver could have zero copper.
Hmm.
So it's not always that liver is a high copper food. So we can't rely on that.
Is chicken livers are higher in copper than beef liver, right?
I would presume that they might be.
I thought that.
Because chicken is actually fed lots of copper, but they're also fed lots of fluoride. In fact, they're fed so much fluoride that it would break their bones. They have to give them high copper to prevent their bones from breaking. It's kind of a funny thing.
That's interesting.
Okay, here's the thing. To put it in context, water is fluoridated at 0.7 milligrams per liter. Chicken feed is 130 parts per million or 130 milligrams per liter. 0.7 in the water, 130 in chicken feed. So chicken feed is so high fluoride, it would literally kill a human being if we tried to eat it. But how do the chickens get away with it? Maybe because they're making eggs? I don't know. But they also have to give them about 150 parts per million copper.
Why do they give them fluoride to begin with?
They are using it as an antibiotic.
Oh my God.
So that they don't all just die from disease.
Mm-hmm.
And the copper is also an antibiotic, and the copper helps to prevent the damage that would be caused by the fluoride. So we have found that chicken is a high fluoride food. And my wife and I, every time we eat chicken, we almost always pay for it with an acne pimple somewhere.
Really?
Yes.
We eat a lot of chicken and eggs. And I mean,
doesn't
we
seem
try
to be
to,
affecting you at all.
I mean, who knows? Maybe that's my eyesight problem.
I don't know.
Okay. So what about testing? So what do you recommend? What is the best test when you want to find out if you're copper deficient?
Okay, there are three tests that you could do to determine your copper levels, but none of them are good and none of them are viable and you can't do it. And the common blood tests and hair tests, those are worse. Okay, because copper hides out in the bone marrow and in the liver. So a blood test is not going to detect that. And in fact, when the blood is high in copper, they call that copper toxicity, but that's only a correlation. And the body will mobilize copper into the blood in situations where the body needs the copper. So when you're copper deficient, the body will flood the blood supply with copper, but it's just copper deficiency, not copper toxicity. So if you look at the copper toxicity advocates out there, they'll say, well, copper toxicity mirrors all these copper deficiency symptoms, and therefore it's really hard to tell, and that's why you need a blood test. Nope, 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 nope. They've got it all wrong. They've got it all wrong. High copper in the blood does not mean copper toxicity because you don't know what is in the liver and in the bones. So those three tests that could tell you, but you can't use, nobody's going to do a liver biopsy because people die from liver biopsies at a rate of 1 in 1,000.
Really?
So that's not a viable thing to do. And bone marrow biopsies are probably even riskier and more dangerous and more painful. And that's not how you need to test for minerals. And then the third one would be a full body cremation test. I don't think you want to even chop off a pinky to know what's in your body to determine your mineral levels. Not worth it. You don't need to go through all of that because what would be the point of testing in the first place? Because you want to know that you're not copper toxic. But if copper toxicity is a false fear, there's no need to test. And here's why copper toxicity is a false fear. It's fraudulent because real copper toxicity happens only about once per year in remote India, where somebody drinks an entire bottle full of copper sulfate trying to kill themselves. They get about 20,000 milligrams of copper sulfate or in copper in the form of copper sulfate in one dose, and they rarely die. They rarely die.
Hmm.
It's only 15% of them who die who do that. And so that's like what? One person every 8 years will die from this. And when they are dying, it might very well be that they die from a hospital intervention and not
right.
the copper that they took, because they'll try to pump the stomach and they'll rupture the stomach from the vacuum tube that they put into the stomach. And when the stomach tissues get sucked up into the vacuum, they're going to bleed to death. And so if they die from that, did they die from the copper sulfate? Maybe not. Or they'll give them a ton of chelating drugs, which are chelators to try to absorb the minerals. Well, maybe the chelators bind with the copper, and then there's too much trying to be exited at once through the poop and the urine and the liver.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're dying from that medical intervention and not from the copper sulfate itself. The body itself will protect itself from copper sulfate poisoning by vomiting. And in fact, so if only 15% of people are dying from 20,000 milligrams, again, that's not necessarily copper toxicity. And in fact, some people have taken 200,000 milligrams or 100,000 milligrams and not died. Not even having liver problems. So how in the world is copper toxic at 2 milligrams when people are surviving 100,000 milligrams? Something's not right here.
Yeah.
What's right is the evidence that they claim it's toxic because the evidence is only a correlation of a high blood test, which means nothing. Again, these high copper in the blood, all pregnant women have copper in the blood at 100% higher than normal. Why? Because babies are high in copper. Babies' bodies have 10 times as much copper in their bodies than an adult on average. They don't have any copper toxicity problems at all. They need the copper for growth. So copper is not toxic at all, and you don't need to test at all. Just take the copper and get healed.
Right. It's interesting because it reminds me a lot of progesterone. And I know progesterone is a signaling molecule and it's a hormone, but it reminds me of it in that, they've never discovered a toxic level of progesterone in the body. They You know, the more a pregnant woman has in her body, the better she seems to do, the better she seems to avoid preeclampsia and gestational diabetes and all the things that come along, and especially PND, right? Postnatal depression. So that's very similar in that way. And then they say, well, look how much progesterone is in this woman's test or blood or her urine or whatever. And then it's like, well, how do we know it's not there trying to oppose all of that and modulate all that estrogen? And right. So the copper makes sense. So it makes sense because the work, as I'm sure you know, about the Carl Pfeiffer and William Walsh, found that many of their patients with schizophrenia, ADHD, and autism had clear levels of elevated copper, and that approaches to remedy the excess copper helped, especially for schizophrenia. And they had broken down the category into four categories.
Yes.
And copper was the largest category where they had the most copper in their systems. And what you just said could make perfect sense. It's like, well, this person is having some kind of major biochemical overload of some sort, and the copper is actually there doing its best to try to mitigate it or something.
What I find very interesting in what you said, and I have to have a good answer for this, is that when they tried to lower the copper, they actually got better in like something like 70% of cases, which for them affirmed that they were correct. But the trouble is, there's no such thing as lowering copper in isolation. Every bit of intervention you do that lowers copper is also going to lower a wide array of toxins. So for example, they would give these people zinc and vitamin C. Zinc and vitamin C are on our protocol because those are good. Vitamin C is widely regarded as one of the most effective vitamins, you know, out there. And zinc is great because it detoxes. Zinc helps to make metallothionines, which detoxes lead, mercury, cadmium, and arsenic.
That was my next question.
So if you're eliminating all of those four toxins while you're eliminating copper, you have what's called, you've introduced covariables by introducing zinc to eliminate the copper.
Right.
So yes, zinc is great. That's why they did better. Not because you eliminated copper. You know, if you eliminate four toxins plus also copper, oops, you're still doing great things. So imagine how much better they would have done if they introduced copper also, but they did not do that because of their bias.
Well, that was my next question, was about metallothionein, because when metallothionein levels are normal in our bodies, we are chelating metal and getting rid of metal all the time. And of course, copper is a metal. So how does that, like, I guess it's a balancing act. As usual.
You can't think of metallothionines as bad.
No.
They're good.
Yeah.
And in fact, so what we recommend is when people start our protocol.
For people that don't know, it is a protein involved in metal detox.
Or an enzyme. Well, actually, metallothionine should be said as metallothionines, plural, because it's a whole family of metal enzymes that remove metals like copper and mercury and lead. And I want to stop on lead for a second because, you know, if we say fluoride is toxic, we're in the area of controversy. Let's stay in the area that's not controversial. Everybody says lead is toxic, even the government. You know, we're using unleaded gasoline. If there's lead paint in a house, that has to be disclosed on a real estate prospectus. We all know lead is bad. Well, if the entire society knows lead is bad, why doesn't the entire society know exactly how to detoxify lead? We should all know that in order to detoxify lead, we need copper, zinc, selenium, maybe colloidal gold, maybe blueberries. These five things all increase metallothionines in the body, which detox mercury, lead, cadmium, and arsenic as a bonus. And in fact, these metallothionines are associated with a better functioning brain. Well, of course, we just listed a bunch of neurotoxins, as well as associated with increased longevity. So you can't say metallothionines are all bad just because they also might bind and remove copper and zinc, because metallothionines also superoxide dismutase and a whole host of copper containing enzymes contain copper. That doesn't mean that they're bad. What we do is we tell people, when you start our protocol, start on 5 milligrams of copper, break it up into 2 milligrams 3 times a day, because you have to slowly work up past the nausea factor. Because 50% of people are going to get nauseous on copper at 3 to 4 milligrams. So how do you start at 5? Break it up 3 times a day. Do that for a couple of weeks. Then increase to 10 milligrams. Stay at 10 milligrams for a month. Why 10 milligrams for a month? Because what happens is most people, they only absorb about half the copper they get. But when you start taking 10 milligrams, your body starts letting go of almost all the copper that you're taking in. In other words, copper is easily excreted. Now, you see the bias in the articles when they say, oh, this proves the body has a homeostatic mechanism to try to eliminate copper, because this proves that copper is a poison. Well, excuse me, wait a second. All poisons are poisonous because they build up in the body. Copper, because it is rapidly and easily excreted, does not have the profile of poison. It has the profile of something that, because it's rapidly and easily excreted, is perfectly capable, therefore, of binding to the real toxins and eliminating them. So how in the world can they have it both ways and claim that copper is toxic and builds up easily when it's rapidly and easily excreted? They can't have it both ways.
Right.
So it's proof that copper is not poisonous because it's rapidly and easily excreted. But to get to that rapid and easily excreted point, it takes a month of 10 milligrams of copper per day, and then it becomes rapidly and easily excreted. So what happens is the body builds up its capacity to make metallothionines, and then when the body learns how to excrete harmless copper, it then also excretes and begins excreting all the other toxins like lead and mercury along with it.
Wow. Can you speak a little, well, again, just when going back to what you said about, you know, giving a child this copper drink that helps them if they poison themselves to help them to puke it up. Mm-hmm. Why would you give that to a child that poisoned themselves unless you wanted to poison them?
No, right. And remove the poison, right? You wouldn't give them another poison now, would you?
Right.
And certainly not at 100 milligrams. And, you know, it certainly can't be poisonous if we take 2 milligrams a day. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So can you speak a little more about copper and hormones? A lot of women in my group, have posted in the past, and just the other day, I think I read it where someone was referencing, I can't take progesterone because I was copper toxic. And I was copper toxic for so long. And a lot of women say I'm copper toxic, so I can't eat that. And I can't do this. I've been copper toxic. And I know it's because they went to get an HTMA test by somebody who probably didn't entirely know what they were doing and saw that their copper was high and assumed that they're maybe even the highest thing they had in their HTMA test. And they were like, your symptoms are probably because you have too much copper. So you're copper toxic, right?
Yeah, these are just simply bad conclusions by the C-minus students of the world. I was an A-plus student when I was in school and in college. I took honors classes. I was able to get an A when I really applied myself to the subject. And I have applied myself to the subject of copper very diligently for the past 6 years.
Can we not talk about school grades, please? Oh.
No, I will admit, in the subjects that I was not interested in, I would get like a C just to try to get by.
You know what? I was a terrible student. And you know why? Probably because I was copper deficient.
Hmm. I have to admit, I've become a much better student now in my older age as I have fixed my own copper deficiency problem. And I admit that I entered a period of brain fog when I tested not taking any copper because I didn't like the nausea. Huge, huge mistake. But sometimes we learn the most from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So
copper and hormones.
I think I have proven that they don't understand copper very well and that they often get it wrong when they try to make these associational studies. Because the association is not causation, because copper could be high in the blood because the body's trying to heal.
Or in the tissues.
It's trying to heal the tissues. So if there's tissue damage, like your hand gets burned, copper goes high in the blood to try to heal the tissues. So very clearly, when that's happening, then when there's associated with other disease states, you can't say copper's the cause. Copper's there to heal, and it's mobilized to heal, and it's mobilized from where? We even know where it's mobilized from. It's mobilized from out of the bone marrow. The vast majority of copper studies suggest that copper is the highest concentration in the liver. Not true. It's probably 2 to 3, 4, 5 times as densely, milligrams per gram of tissue in bone marrow than in liver. Almost all of the copper studies are getting that wrong. So with regards to estrogen and progesterone, I will admit that progesterone, I really don't know a lot about because I just haven't made it an area of study.
Mm-hmm.
But I know how they've gotten it wrong with understanding what estrogen does, because estrogen is blamed on things like causing cancer. However, where is estrogen, high estrogen found? It's found in pregnant women, and pregnant women get cancer at rates that are 1/20th of normal women. Mm-hmm. So how in the world, if estrogen causes cancer, why aren't pregnant women getting cancer left and right?
Because they also have very, very high progesterone, which is the regulator to estrogen.
that could be the answer. I'm not going to dispute that. But the point is, there's really no way to know what estrogen does in the body except by two methods. They either measure the high levels, which is a correlational study, which means nothing, or B, they will introduce it and inject it to the body or give it a tablet or whatever. Just because it's natural doesn't mean that when you give it, that it has the function that it was supposed to have. Because if you remember my argument that I made earlier, what if the body needs copper to make estrogen, but you give estrogen without the copper, what if the estrogen signal is, hey, there's enough copper now to make a baby? But if you give estrogen without the copper, that's a wonky signal to send to the body, especially when it's not trying to make a baby, and especially also when there's not the copper there. Or a third factor you just introduced, which I didn't even know about until you just said it, if there's not enough progesterone there also.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
So what's the problem of estrogen? One of the things they found is that it causes cancer. Well, here's the thing. We've discovered also that cancer is from a copper deficiency, because copper will cure cancer in a wide variety of ways. Cancer is a metabolic disease where the body is no longer making ATP. We need to make ATP. We need copper, magnesium, and B vitamins. Mm-hmm. If copper is not there, it won't convert the oxygen that we breathe in to the energy that we need.
Mm. Good. Copper's That's good
the
stuff.
The key linchpin to make and convert oxygen that we breathe into the energy that we need. That's mm-hmm. a huge point. So.
Well, it seems like, go ahead.
Copper kills mold. People associate cancer with mold, and it's so often assumed that anyone with cancer also has a mold problem, they give people antifungal medicines that instant they find out that they have cancer. Well, copper kills mold, boron kills mold, and iodine kill mold. So just the mold-killing power of copper alone shows that it has anti-cancer activity too. Also, what is cancer caused by? It's caused by definition by this class of things that go by the name of carcinogens. Well, what are carcinogens? Carcinogens are poisons. What does copper do? It detoxifies poisons. So, of course, copper is going to get at the root cause of the things that cause cancer in multiple ways, mm-hmm. by giving the body energy, by detoxifying, by killing mold.
I say that this just came to my mind. Okay. I'm very proud of it.
Okay.
Progesterone is to estrogen as copper is to iron. So
progesterone keeps estrogen in check, like copper keeps iron in check, but it's needed to make it work right.
It's essential. Like, what? Right. Who would we be if we had no iron in our systems?
Right.
You know, who would we be if we had no estrogen in our systems?
Right. I mean, we can't say that iron is a toxin and you can't take it. That would be taking it too far. But if everybody is already eating a high iron foods, we certainly don't need to supplement it. And in fact,
right.
Iron in supplements is probably one of the only things that correlates with early death. It actually does. So, copper is the cure for that.
That's very cool. I mean, it's also the same what did you just say before the correlates with early death is
high iron in right. supplements correlates with early death.
Yeah.
Now, the second most thing that correlates with early death is copper, but it's not copper as the cause. It's because copper is co-present with all of that high iron that's killing people.
Mm.
So if you look at any pharmaceutical made supplement, it's typically, you know, anywhere between 15 to 40 milligrams of iron and only 3 milligrams of copper or less. So they're both there together, but not in the right ratios. And the iron is still overpowering that copper in that supplement. So my wife, she had an anemia problem. She was bleeding horribly. And she was taking iron to try to solve it. I mean, started taking a lot more. And we were working on it for 6 months. And we were taking absolutely everything that would help the body absorb iron. More vitamin C, more B vitamins, more copper. She was taking 9 milligrams of copper now. and only like, 45 milligrams of like naturally sourced iron. And the problem was high constipation. And constipation is a known problem of high iron. So eventually she's like, her period length was, she's given me permission to say this just so that you know.
I think I probably already know a lot of this.
It's in our iron and anemia article. And so she was having, period length of 20 days and super heavy bleeding. And she thought she was going to bleed to death. And we did some study on how much blood can the body make. And we realized the body theoretically should be still able to make more blood than she's losing. She's losing maybe a cup a day at most, which was still very heavy bleeding. But the body can make up to 10 cups of blood in a day. So we're like, okay, so you're not really at super risk of not being able to replenish the blood, but the trouble is we still got to get a hold of the bleeding. So we reasoned that if the high iron was causing constipation, but our body's loaded with iron, so that no longer, let's just try to go without the iron, because we at least also now have to fix the constipation issue. So when we cut out the iron and increased the copper and did a couple more things to stop bleeding, like more leafy greens and her period length with on higher copper dramatically cut down to 10 days. And then we increased the copper a little bit further, and then it cut all the way back down to like 3 days. And finally, it was like 2 days, 3 days, and very low bleeding, all because we got rid of the iron problem.
That's great. And
And
she
we had to
was
take it.
not any, on any hormones.
Well, she was diagnosed anemia. And
But
no,
she wasn't taking any progesterone or
she
anything.
was occasionally taking some testosterone, trying to use progesterone creams.
That's impressive. That's really good. I mean, that's something that, Morley is always, that's how we met. He was really trying to help me with that same issue and then help all the women because I had my group and then I had, Ona's a progesterone cream, and he was really trying to figure out how can he help these women without with the root cause protocol, but also using progesterone. But that's really, really impressive that she was able to do that with the copper. And then so that's the thing. I have you probably noticed this in my blogs or whatever, is my big issue was I was educated to not is not ideal to take minerals in isolation. It's not ideal to just take iodine. It's not ideal to just take maybe magnesium is like the only thing that I would take in isolation. And so when I saw
I
your,
generally agree with you because
yeah,
we take so many co-nutrients.
so I saw your protocol and I was like, when I saw Copper Revolution, I was like, oh, I wonder if this is copper in isolation. And then
Right.
I read and I was like, oh, well, that isn't a, it's, it is copper.
It's
But you're
revolutionary because
also
nobody else recommends high copper. That's
right.
the big change.
But it's not being done in isolation. You're doing all these
No,
other cofactors
absolutely
and
not. We're
things
doing
to
like
help
20
support.
nutrients. Now, that brings me to one other issue that was in my notes that I prepared for the show, and that is you said you would do magnesium in isolation.
I mean, I
I know what the problems are with
tell
that.
us because so many women have bad reactions. I don't, but so
Oh,
many women
interesting.
do.
Bad reactions. So one of the bad reactions could be inducing a copper deficiency. So one of the things that you'll notice with magnesium is they often will say there's no possible way you can get enough because everyone also suffers from magnesium wasting. One of the things, and I said, what did I say? Everybody suffers from copper deficiency. What does copper deficiency cause? Magnesium wasting. Copper helps us retain magnesium, and so also does boron. Boron helps us retain magnesium. So when we are high copper and high boron, we're fixing the magnesium wasting problem. And the magnesium wasting problem gets worse the more magnesium you try to take. So that's one of the problems with taking magnesium in isolation. And in fact, we tested it out and we decided to see how effective it would be that copper and boron are in helping us retain magnesium. So we decided to not take any magnesium and see how long we could go. I went a whole year and then I caved and said, nope, we got to have the magnesium. So that's pretty good for a test, but now we're only taking 200 milligrams of magnesium about every other day. Well, whenever we take our B vitamins, we take 200 to 300 milligrams of magnesium, and that's about every other day.
Okay.
And that's all we need because we're retaining it well.
That's really
why
interesting.
I know that I needed it is because I tried to start running again and I had foot fractures and pain in my feet that wasn't healing. And one of the things that fixed it was increasing the magnesium.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. Well, your protocol, well, so your book, where can we get your book?
The book's only available at Amazon.
Okay.
Sorry.
And it's called Copper Revolution.
Yes.
And then the protocol, you sent me a link so I can attach that to the show notes so everyone can check out your protocol and check out how you make your topical copper solution and all of, and the dosing and all of that, right?
That's right. That's
okay,
right.
Okay, so that'll be in the show notes.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. What else? Do you have anything else you want to add on to this? I was going to say, you know, there's such an abundance of iron on this planet in our food. It's such an abundance everywhere. And there's such an abundance of estrogen and xenoestrogens, but it's the copper and the progesterone that are harder to acquire than it is. I mean, it's easier to acquire copper than it is to acquire progesterone, but with copper, you probably make progesterone better.
Well, you probably can't really get copper from foods like, so beef is beef liver's out as a copper source. And then also the oysters and sea shellfish are out as a source because they're so loaded with zinc.
Mm-hmm.
So the only other good source of copper is like, say, dark chocolate. Some people have dark chocolate cravings.
Mm-hmm.
And it could very well be that it's the copper and perhaps also the magnesium found in dark chocolate that kind of make that so good for us.
Yeah, so it's hard to get.
It's really hard to get from foods. And so mm-hmm. I can't honestly recommend just eating that much dark chocolate. You'd have to have like a pound or half a pound.
I'll try it.
I know, right? So we take a copper sulfate supplement we make ourselves. We make about, it's only 5/8 of a teaspoon of copper sulfate into a 2-ounce dropper bottle. And that makes a 1,100 milligram solution at 1 milligram per drop. So I just take a few drops in my coffee every morning, a few drops in my second cup of coffee every morning. And then I'm getting my 30 milligrams orally that way. And then we just apply it to our skin. We just put the solution right on our forearms, rub it in, our chest, rub it in, back, rub it in, arms, upper arms, legs, rub it in. And about 10 applications of about 7 drops in the palm of our hand, that's another 70 drops that's absorbed easily topically that we might be getting a good, you know, 30 to 50% more absorption of that.
Mm.
And I have found that when I added that much more copper, foot pain went away. I have flat feet, so foot pain's come up. That's one of my, I call them now my weaknesses are like my superpower because when they show up, I know I'm not doing things right and I need to fix it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's just a way of looking at things.
Yeah. Perspective.
Yeah. They're like my little canary in the coal mine for my body.
Exactly.
Telling me, hey, get it on track. And then when the pain goes away, that means I'm doing it right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
So do you, so the topical solution can be done right away or do I have to wait a month to do the 5 milligram broken up in a day for a month before I start the topical, or can you start the topical right away as well?
You can probably start the topical right away. When my wife started topical, she got nausea. I got mild, very mild nausea. It hit her worse
mm-hmm.
Because she probably has more of a fluoride issue to deal with because she took Prozac for 7 years.
Mm.
Prozac is a fluoride containing medication. And so she had more, probably had more fluoride buildup. And so it detoxed her harder. So the first 5 times she did topical copper, she got nausea. And it was less and less each time. And water helped tremendously, made it go away. So just, you know, my point is don't do so much copper that you're feeling nauseated and don't try to push through it. Back off and let time do the work and then push it in 2 weeks.
Mm.
And then there shouldn't be any nausea there. And as long as there's no nausea, then you can slowly increase. I'd still like people to stay at 10 milligrams per day for a good, you know, month before increasing. You know, why push it? Your body still, it takes a month for the body to turn on its betalathionine production to help eliminate it. So if you what I've seen
to
is to help eliminate the copper. What I've seen is when people try to rush it, they end up with metallic copper taste in the mouth.
Mm.
Because it's coming out in the saliva and it's just awful. It's just because they've rushed it. And there's no need to go through that discomfort either.
So I thought the nausea was maybe from detoxing other metals and other stuff.
Well, there's that on the, that's from the nausea. But then if you take too much copper, it does these other weird things because the body's not eliminating it right. The body's processing it through the liver appropriately or quickly enough. Okay. It's not putting it into the bile. I think a lot of the copper is eliminated through the bile, but some also gets eliminated through the sweat and through the urine. It's just that the body doesn't quite eliminate it very easily if you go too high too quick, mm-hmm. or you're more likely to accidentally puke. We don't want people to have to suffer from that.
Mm-hmm. So before we wrap it up, I want to hear some testimonials about like some of the most dramatic healing crises you've seen turn around from copper, from this protocol, like, oh, you know, yeah, like just a few.
Just a few. Mm-hmm. Some of these people who had the dramatic healing testimonies we've invited to be our moderators, and some of them have gone on and left. But I think some of the biggest ones are people who were suffering from mercury toxicity and a whole host of very difficult problems. Sometimes people have said, look, I've had 10 major chronic neurodegenerative conditions. And we get a lot of testimonials like this. Like they're like, I'm hypothyroid, I've got Graves' disease, I've got mercury toxicity, my digestion's horrible. And they're just listing all the, I mean, just they sound Lyme disease and mold. And I mean, just they sound like a wreck. And they also list and they say, bedbound, can't move, no life. I think I'm going to die soon.
Aww.
I had, nothing to lose. And so therefore I tried the copper in your protocol and all my health problems went away, except I'm still working on digestion a little bit.
Hmm.
I mean,
that's amazing.
Dramatic that you can do that much within say 6 months.
Wow.
And a lot of people, they get, when they start copper, they get energy almost right away, but it comes in like fits and spurts. And then they're crashing them and having energy crashes on copper. And that's partly because copper also makes us more sensitive to insulin. And so when you're more sensitive to insulin, you're reversing diabetes. But the problem is your body's used to cranking out a certain amount of insulin. And when all of a sudden that insulin starts working, the blood sugar levels go so low that the person's having a blood sugar crash with no energy. So this happened to my buddy even, and he was in pretty good shape. But when he took more copper the following day, the following morning, he was like, oh my God, I feel like I'm going to die. I have to eat because his blood sugar crashed. So in the beginning, if you get these fits and starts, you've got high energy moments and blood sugar crashes and people are like, what's going on? It's because things are working better and your body has to adjust. So it just takes time. And there's reasons why you don't want to overdo things right at the start. And you just want to slowly, gradually make the transition into them.
Yeah.
One more thing I wanted to say about progesterone. One more thing I wanted to say about copper in the gut, because you're a healthy gut girl. Number one is my general view is I don't like to take any sort of hormones because the problem is the body tends to make less. But as my readers have pointed out, this does not happen with progesterone. Your body does not start making less and it doesn't have that negative side effect. I said, well, that's great, but I'm a man, so I really don't care. But I have to put that in there because
hey,
I know you're...
Hey, that's not true. Progesterone, men need progesterone just as much. In fact, you know, when men start getting old, you know, when they get into their 70s and stuff, and they're
too far away from me now.
Well, they start to have this feminized look to them. And, if you look at men, older men, they start, look at all these old rock stars, right, that they are showing on their like... And it's because estrogen is dominating, even at low levels. It's in the tissues. It's dominating.
Yeah, the testosterone is converted to estrogen. That's a
aromatase
problem
to estrogen, and it totally has no progesterone to offset that and to oppose it. And so I know a lot of men. In fact, I'm just now starting my husband on progesterone again. He was on it a while back, but he's going to have a surgery soon, a knee surgery.
Oh, so it helps to keep estrogen in check, which can be a man problem, the estrogen.
Yeah. And if you're absolutely, if you're, you know, and he's a high T kind of guy. And when he's not able to exercise and work out and he's getting a little more inflammation, let's say, because he's more sedentary, he's going to convert that estrogen, that testosterone into estrogen and, you know, potentially raise his blood pressure, all kinds of joint pain, healing, slowing down healing. But after, that's why there's so many interesting correlations here with copper. I really love it. I'm starting to actually think I want to do some experiments.
I've done my job.
You have. I'll have to talk to you about it more. Morley was the one who originally incited it, but now this is really interesting because he recommended that I do copper liver chelate. And is that what it's called?
Yeah. Well, I think he's got there's a supplement out there that's
before
a combination
that.
Of a liver plus a copper chelate. Yeah.
Way before that. It was made by Standard Process, I think. It was called copper liver chelate, I think. And I didn't take much of it. I didn't notice a huge difference, but now I know why after talking to you, because it's very low dose.
I really didn't notice very much from my copper until when I was taking 10 milligrams or under. It's only when I got to 20 to 30 milligrams that it literally changed my life. And a lot of people are like that. They're like, you're just not taking enough copper at 10 milligrams. You can barely tell. It's when you get to 20 and 30. Now, you used a phrase, mineral balancing. While they all have to be in balance, and while our overall view is that we don't want to take too much of any one thing, we actually intentionally take excess amounts of copper, excess amounts of iodine, excess amounts of boron, all because we know that they're rapidly and easily excreted. In fact, magnesium works also well as a great detox nutrient because it's rapidly and easily excreted. That's the pattern of the good minerals. They're rapidly and easily excreted.
Yes.
It's the toxins that build up. So they try to have it both ways with copper.
And that's so great. You were going to say.
Gut is, I have an article on my page. It says copper helps to heal the gut in 20 ways. I've slowly been building it up. I've gotten now 20 different mechanisms that some of them overlap a little bit, but I will direct you and your readers to take a look at that article on my page. I think you'll find it fascinating and very helpful for your, readers, listeners, viewers, and followers to see how many different ways copper heals the gut. And if I can run a few of them off just off the top.
Yeah,
of my
head, I'm really curious.
It helps us make both bile as well as hydrochloric acid.
Really?
It helps build collagen in the body so it thickens the lining of the stomach. Mm-hmm. It heals ulcers and stops bleeding.
Wow.
Improve digestion by strengthening muscle tone so that you get the contractions in your intestines, the peristalsis.
Uh-huh.
It, a lot of people on copper, they say my digestion has just improved so much. It increases hydration in the body because it acts as an electrolyte, and we need more hydration to fix things like, why do we even get ulcers in the first place? Very often it's from painkillers, which cause copper depletion and then cause the ulcers. Or it's from H. pylori, they say. Well, I don't know if that's necessarily a cause, but the pylori might be there when there's an open wound. But the point is, copper also kills germs. So it restores the balance of the gut flora by eliminating the bad ones so that the good ones can flourish. A lot of times when people hear that copper and these other minerals like iodine are antibiotics, they go, well, isn't that going to destroy all my gut bacteria? It just doesn't happen. People have actually an increased diversity of gut bacteria when they're taking copper because they're controlling the bad bacteria. And there's no reason for the bad bacteria to be there from ulcers that are then healed. So it's just, it heals in so many different ways, and they all balance each other. Like, we need better blood flow. Copper increases blood flow. We need better hormones. Copper increases hormones. I mean, it's just so many.
Yeah. Well, I'll add to that, because Morley and I had this discussion about, you know, the lining of the gut and the tight junctions that are in the gut. They're like, it's almost like an electrical fence, and it's actually charged by, you know, mineral, I'm going to say mineral balance, but he's going to say by bioavailable copper, and you're going to say probably by copper. And so, you know, it's like there's this integrity, this energetic integrity that's happening in the gut. And cortisol has this life cycle that ends in the gut. And so when people have high cortisol and they're super stressed out, it ends in the gut. And that bacteria that's meant to process that is damaged. And when that's damaged, it affects the energetic connection in the lining of the stomach and the lining of intestines, and it makes makes it permeable and leaky. And so
there's a cascade of problems that all get fixed with copper. And I can't believe you said the one that I failed to mention, the leaky gut. Copper is an astringent, so it tightens pores. So I think it probably fixes leaky gut.
Well, I think the copper from a mineral, from an energetic perspective, probably plays a role in that as well as the leaky gut aspect. I mean, as the porous, permeable aspect. So that makes sense to me. I mean, I've always believed that minerals were at the root of all of it, you know, and my mentor was real big on mineral balancing, but he did it in a very different way than people do. But this resonates with me, really.
It's
does.
It's really amazing that society has overlooked copper. I'm just astounded that I was able to find my way into it by wondering, well, what exactly is the dose that causes some liver harm? And I wrote my book, I was like, oh, copper heals all these things, but probably not the liver and the kidneys. And I did further study and I found that copper deficiency causes liver and kidney problems, and that copper itself heals a lot of liver problems and kidney problems. In fact, my wife, she actually was diagnosed with fatty liver problems and high enzymes, liver enzymes. And on our high copper protocol, she healed from that.
Amazing.
In about 2 years, we don't know. I mean, she could have healed within 1 year, but she went back for testing after 2 years. And sure enough, no high liver enzymes.
Incredible.
2 years. So
that's incredible. That's good news. That's a really big thing in my group too, is a lot of women with fatty liver, which is really common.
It could be from copper deficiency.
Yeah.
It's common.
I mean, the birth control pill, you know, probably depletes copper. I think I talked about that with Morley too. Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah. Well, this has been an eye-opening experience, and I like it. It resonates with me. I think it's really triggered some ideas for myself and for the work that I'm doing. So I'm excited about it, and I'll keep you posted on how I do with it, because I think I'm going to try it.
Yes, please stay in contact. I would love to see how it's going. You probably don't have a lot of as many health problems as a lot of people, because you're so into it and you're doing so many things so well. We're in such an agreement on so many areas. One thing that I have to commend you on is that in your one of your articles, you had a list of foods that were good, and you included both beef and vegetables and fruits all in there. And very often people gravitate and they become too vegan or they become too carnivore. And it's out of balance. And there was a study that I ran across not a couple of years ago or within the last 2 years. And it showed that almost all of the most long-lived health advice people were moderate on just about everything.
Yes.
And all the people that were very gung-ho on high dose of this or that or the other thing all died young.
Oh.
And so I was like, oh, look at how moderate we are. Yes.
Yeah.
To get it in balance. And yet at the same time, I'm taking copper because I know it's rapidly and easily excreted like all the other things. So you don't have to worry about keeping it in balance. Just take plenty and cure what you want to cure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Thank you for that. I'm big on diversity with food. Very big. You know, I'm big on gut diversity, microbiome diversity, and that means eating a lot of everything. Of course, the things that you know you can digest, of course. But, you know, I wonder if someone has done this yet, if they've taken all the vitamins and all the nutrients, right? Minerals, phytonutrients, vitamins, and put them in two categories. And one category is there is no toxic limit. And one is there is a toxic limit. And put them side by side and see, because vitamin K is in the no toxic limit. You can literally eat vitamin K all day long and nothing is going to happen to you.
Right.
And then same with progesterone, sounds like same with copper. And I wonder what those other ones are, because it sounds like we've got a little bit of beautiful yin yang going on. Well, I should say more like a divine design that God's like, yes, yes, exactly, guys. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. Toxins are pretty toxic at really low levels, and nutrients, there's almost no upper limit. So there's only two B vitamins that have our upper limits, and that's B6 and B9. And so we don't take those. We take all the others that don't have any upper limit. So we take B1, B2, B3, B5, B7, and B12, just those six. So you hit exactly upon what we've already done in all of our research.
I would love to see like a like side by side list of nutrients. And
so I have really short lists, but they don't exactly include like the information that you're asking in them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, my article on folate, which is B9, is 11,000 words, and it's so long, not even I want to read it.
I certainly won't.
Right. Okay. That's totally fine. You don't have to. But I understand that, you know, you have to start somewhere. And for me, you have to dive deep, but you also have to research broad. You can't leave anything out. So I've been doing both of those. And in the last 2 years, I've done so much work, more than I thought I was going to do. Like the pace that I wrote the copper book in 4 years, I thought I was going to duplicate that for all of the other minerals. And it was going to be a big 60-year long project. But in the last 2 years, I've done almost all of it. And so
Really?
what you're asking, I've already done. And it's that's why we have the 30 that we don't take and the 20 that we do.
Oh, that's
And
cool.
the only two we didn't discuss was B6 and B9. And they're also very toxic. They're very toxic at very low levels, as well as for vitamin A, B6 and B9, they say the same thing. They say almost nobody is ever found deficient in America. Well, that's interesting because the other thing that if they're not nutrients at all, you would never find a deficiency. Even if a person is deficient, it's not going to cause problems if they're only just toxins. So it seems to me that those three are
Interesting.
just toxins. There's just so much evidence for that.
Yeah. It makes me think about all the things like phytonutrients and, you
Well,
know.
there's another great argument, and people say, well, look, if it's natural, how can it be bad for us? But yet every plant has toxins. That's where we get all our pharmaceuticals from. They're either
Yeah.
fully synthetic from oil, or they're made from, you know, derived plant toxins. Plants have toxins to prevent overgrazing. They
It
all have
also
toxins.
depends on what your body's going to do with it. Like people come into my group all the time and say, fat is, there's nothing wrong with fat. As long as it's healthy fat, you can eat all the fat you want. It's not going to make you fat. And I'm like, well, it really depends on what you're doing with your fat and how the health of your liver is and the state of your gut and all the things, you know? So I just don't buy into that at all.
No,
But I do believe that I really would like to see a breakdown of all the things that are, you know, just not to say you should just take it in abundance, but just, you know, it would be cool to see that. It'd be cool to see the, yeah. Anyway, I could ramble about this all day long.
Yes. Well, I really enjoyed this discussion. I'm glad I had at least a couple of good wow moments with you.
Oh,
You said
good.
that
Me
resonated. I
too.
understand that makes sense. I can understand that in a context that's similar to this. That's important. And
Awesome.
I'm glad I was able to present things that way.
Well, thank you for being here and for all the info I'm going to put in the show notes and say hello to your beautiful wife, Jennifer, for me.
Thank you. I will.
Thank you to Jason. That was so interesting. I was completely taken by that. And I recorded this, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I have been taking some copper. I haven't gotten up to the recommended dose that he was suggesting because I am getting nauseous. And even that's not even at 10 milligrams per day. So I find that super interesting. And I've got to be honest, I'm a little bit nervous, and I probably should go ahead and, you know, do the protocol if I'm going to do it. But I'm a little nervous because my education is such that you do not isolate minerals. And he's saying, don't. And he's saying, you know, take this and take this and take that. But even for me, minerals, that is minerals in isolation. Like the only mineral I take in isolation is magnesium. And even then, I feel funny about that. Like if I take magnesium ongoing, I definitely notice that it does the opposite of what it's supposed to do. Like I'll get foot cramps. You know, ongoing for several nights in a row. And yeah, you say that's potassium. So, but again, that proves my point. You know, when you take a mineral in isolation, you're moving other minerals around. And I just don't feel 100% comfortable about doing that. I'd rather do it with my food. I'd rather work on my gut health. I'd rather go from macro to micro than from micro to macro, if that makes any sense. So I'm not saying don't do it, and I'm not saying that I'm not going to try and continue to do it. I think it's fascinating. I think there's a lot of validity and science behind it, what he's showing and presenting to us. Ironically, today I interviewed Dr. Igor Tabrizian, who is this phenomenal doctor that I've been a super fan of for many, many years now. And he talked a lot about copper and a copper imbalance. And his information is similar, but it definitely says there is a toxic point that you can take too much copper because it does upset the balance in the body. He didn't say toxic point. I take that back.
He did say there is a sweet spot with all minerals and really with copper. And he actually laid out some interesting information as well. But needless to say, I think Jason's research is incredible. I think what he presented to us today is super fascinating, and it really makes me want to go down that, you know, that protocol. And so I will try it soon, I promise. But I just want to thank him for coming and thank his wife for introducing us way back when. And also just be a sister group to theirs. And if you guys want to jump into that group, that information is in the show notes, and see what, you know, what might work for you. And that's what I want to say to, in closing, is we're presented with so much information. And I see this a lot in my group where women are like, it's so confusing. The conflicting information is maddening. I get it. I totally get it. But it's also, it's a blessing and a curse. It's a double-edged sword, however you want to look at it, a two-sided coin, whatever you want to say, that we have the luxury of sitting at our computer or at our phone any time of day, 24/7, 365, to look up anything we want, to be have access to information that can be life-changing for us. And that is so, that's such a blessing. But it's our responsibility as adults, as responsible adults, to find out what works for us. So if you're going to be the person that takes advantage of all that wonderful information, you can have it both ways and have it be the perfect information just for you. You have to do the homework and dig and find what works for you, because it's not all going to work for you. And it's going to be conflicting depending on who you talk to. So I don't think that's a bad thing. That just goes to show you how complex, you know, this planet is and human beings are. And I think it's a beautiful blessing from God that we have this information at our fingertips. So yeah, that's all I have to say, kids. So have at it. Let me know how it goes. All right.